From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The brassy James Bond theme songs helped create his bold and sexy image. On today's Fresh Air, we continue our series, Big, Bombastic, Brassy, and Trashy, pop culture that may not be subtle, but sure is fun. We're brassy today. First, we'll hear from John Barry, who wrote the 007 theme, scored 11 Bond films, and wrote the themes for Goldfinger and Thunderball. Then we'll hear from Tom Jones. He recorded the theme for Thunderball and had some pretty brassy hits like It's Not Unusual and What's New Pussycat. Brassy, coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Iraq's most revered Shiite Muslim cleric, Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani, is returning to the embattled city of Najaf tomorrow to try to bring an end to 3 weeks of fighting there. NPR's Ivan Watson reports from Najaf.
Najaf is burning, Sistani's spokesman says, and the elderly cleric is returning from medical treatment in London to try to put a stop to the fighting. When Sistani arrives, he may not recognize his hometown. Najaf's old city is an urban battleground. Phone and power lines lie tangled in the streets next to rotting animals. All that's left of the central market is blackened, twisted metal. And those residents too poor or sick to flee have been caught in between two armies. This grieving mother screamed in anguish. She clutched a photo of her 15-year-old son, Nasir, killed, she said, by American snipers while he was on a trip today to get food and water for his besieged family. Ivan Watson, NPR News, Najaf.
A U.S. Army investigation of the prisoner abuse scandal at Abu Ghraib prison found what its leader called serious misconduct and a loss of moral values. General Paul Kern, who led the investigation, told reporters that 27 members of an intelligence unit at the prison were involved in the abuses, either by requesting or condoning them. Four of those people were outside contractors, and the rest were military personnel. General Kern said another 8 people knew about the abuse and failed to report it. The report itself was not released to reporters, but the summary blamed a lack of discipline on the part of the leaders and soldiers and a failure of leadership by the higher command in Iraq. The ads produced by the Swift Vote Veterans for Truth attacking John Kerry continue to roil the political waters. Today, a top lawyer for the president's reelection campaign resigned after he disclosed that he'd provided legal advice to the Swift Vote vets, NPR's John McChesney reports.
The Bush campaign has insisted that it has no ties to the Swift Boat Veterans Group, and when he resigned today, Benjamin Ginsburg insisted that he had done nothing illegal and was proud to have advised the veterans. Under federal election laws, groups like the Swift Boat Veterans are allowed to raise money and sponsor advertising, but they are forbidden to coordinate their efforts with the candidates' campaigns. Ginsburg said he was resigning so that his relationship with the vets group doesn't distract from the president's reelection effort. A Kerry campaign spokesperson said Ginsburg's resignation only confirms the extent of connections between the veteran group's attack ads and the Bush campaign. Ginsburg, for his part, said that his work for Swift Boat Vets was no different than Kerry campaign lawyers working with independent liberal groups like MoveOn.org attacking the president. John McChesney, NPR News.
The Dow gained 83 points today to close at 10,181 in active trading. This is NPR News. An Australian man has pleaded not guilty to war crimes and murder charges before a military tribunal at the Guantanamo Bay Naval Base in Cuba. David Hicks had been held at the prison camp for 2.5 years. He's accused of fighting with the Taliban against U.S. forces in Afghanistan. Marion Jones will run for the United States in the Olympic 400-meter relay. There had been speculation the American track star would be left off the relay team because she's being investigated by the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency. NPR's Tom Goldman reports from Athens.
Marion Jones qualified for the long jump final today, but Wednesday's big news was that she'll also do at these Olympics what she does best, run. Jones won the 100 and 200 meter sprints at the 2000 Sydney Games, but she failed to qualify for both events at last month's track and field trials. Running the 400 meter relay was her only sprint opportunity in Athens, but until today's decision by Coach Sue Humphrey, Jones's participation was in doubt. Some recommended not using her because she's being investigated for possible doping. Although Jones hasn't been charged with anything, there was concern that if she's found guilty, the U.S. could lose any medal it wins. Jones will run second in the relay. Other team members are Angela Williams, Latasha Colander, and Olympic 100-meter silver medalist Lauren Williams. Tom Goldman, NPR News, Athens.
Psychiatrist Elizabeth Kubler-Ross has died after a long battle with stroke. She was 78. Kubler-Ross was best known for her work with terminally ill patients. In her 1969 book On Death and Dying, she identified five stages that dying people pass through, from grief to acceptance. In stocks, the NASDAQ gained 23 to 1860. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Pew Charitable Trusts at pewtrusts.org, promoting understanding of issues at the intersection of religion and public affairs through the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's day three of our series Big, Bombastic, Brassy, and Trashy, pop culture that may not be subtle, but sure is fun. Today, we're brassy. Later, we'll hear from Tom Jones. First, John Barry, the composer who wrote the music that helped make James Bond so cool and so hot, mixing electric guitar with lots of brass. Barry scored about 100 films and won Oscars for his music for The Lion in Winter, Born Free, Out of Africa, and Dances with Wolves. He wrote the 007 theme, the scores for 11 of the Bond movies, and wrote such memorable Bond-themed songs as Thunderball and Goldfinger. Did I say brassy? That's Shirley Bassey singing the theme from Goldfinger. In 1999, I asked composer John Barry about writing the song.
Well, there's no songs about villains. You don't, you know, people don't sit down and write songs about villains. They write love songs, they write sad songs, they write torch songs, whatever. But songs about villains are very rare. And then I thought of Kurt Weill's Mack the Knife, which is the definitive song about a villain. So then I got my head on right, and I thought, that's the definitive song. He managed to bring off the most extraordinary song about a villain. And so I sat down and wrote this rather strange melody, just based on the word Goldfinger, as the opening line. And then I thought, well, who can write a lyric to this? So Anthony Newley and Leslie Bricus had also just got a huge theatrical success in England called Stop the World, I Want to Get Off. And I knew Tony very well. I phoned him up and I said, look, I've written this song, I've written the melody, but I haven't got the song. I'd like to meet with you. I went out to his home in Hampstead, played him it, and he said, well, what the hell is it all about? And I said, it's Mack the Knife. It's a song about the villain. And he said, got it. Then I'd worked with Shirley in concerts. I'd done concerts tours with her, and she was very big in England at that time. And Shirley has this one thing. She has such conviction about what she does. So I played her the song, and she said, well, what the hell is this about? It's about a villain, Shirley. I said, don't think too much about it, Shirley. Just go into the studio and convince the world that you know what you're doing. And you can do that, because I've worked with you in the theater, and you do this better than anybody else I know. We then went in and recorded it. And originally, it just started off with the chords. Dee-dum. And there was no bar. Yeah, 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 yeah. That wasn't there then. And we had a break. They went up for their 10-minute tea break. And in the tea break, I just found it that what we were playing, that was empty. So I sat down at the piano and I came up with a da-ya-na-na-dan and did it on Wow Wow Trumpets. And we put that in, which just kind of brought it to life. And then we repeated it down the line. When Harry Saltzman heard it... He was one of the producers. Harry, I can't tell you what he said.
He hated it, huh?
He said, that is the worst song I have ever heard in my life. But we're stuck with it because we don't have any time and the movie's coming out. And Guy Hamilton, who was the director... he was in the Air Force. He was one of the few who fought the Battle of Britain, and he's very proper and very splendid man. He said, well, I don't know whether it's going to be a hit or not, Harry, but I know dramatically it works for the movie. And Cubby Broccoli said, I like it. I like it. Let's do it. Let's do it.
Now, you mentioned that Leslie Bricusse and Anthony Newley wrote the lyric for Goldfinger. There's actually a terrific Anthony Newley recording that was released a few years ago on a kind of reissue compilation.
No, because when we'd done the record, they said, you know, how do we demonstrate it to them? So I went in the studio with Tony and a bass and a bongo. I think that was the full orchestration. And I love Tony's recording, and I'd have loved to have been in the movie, but that's maybe why they didn't get the drift of it in the initial thing, you know. I love Tony's recording.
I think this version is a little more orchestrated than bass and bongo, and this is a much more kind of sneaky vocal version than the really brassy Shirley.
That's
Bassey
right, exactly.
One. So here's Anthony Newley.
Goldfinger, he's the man with the Midas touch, a spider's touch, such a cold finger, beckons you to enter his web of sin. Don't go in. Golden words he will pour in your ear, but his lies can't disguise what you fear. For a golden girl knows when he's kissed her, it's the kiss of death from Mr. Goldfinger.
Oh, that is really great.
I love Tony. I mean, God. Does he know how to point a lyric out? I just love him.
So it's too bad that it wasn't released at the time. I think it could have done well.
I would have thought so.
There's something about your Goldfinger scores songs that remind me a little bit of the Frankie Lane movie themes, those big Western anthems that he used to sing.
Well, it's kind of, you know, I did one or two interviews with the English press at the time, and they said, well, what is it? And I said, it's Million Dollar Mickey Mouse music. Because it's... and it's Wagnerian. I mean, the whole opening of Goldfinger is like this very pretentious... You know, I mean, it's... But that was the fun of it. You know, and as Fred Astaire said, give it size, give it style, and give it class. And that's like an incredible Bible to follow. And... hopefully that's what we did. We just made everything larger than life, and we made it a lot of fun. So everybody went in. They knew he was going to be, he'd get the broad, he'd kill the villain, he'd be happy. And that was the formula. And we enjoyed it on that level.
There's one more James Bond song that I have to get in here, and that's Thunderball. The theme from Thunderball, sung by Tom Jones. I think this is just a particularly fun one also.
Well, There's a kind of fascinating story behind that, because that is probably the worst title for a song you can imagine.
Oh, exactly.
I mean, you know, And I spoke to Tony Newley about it, actually, and he says, what do we do? Thunderball, marvellous, you should care for me. Thunderball. So I said, that's not going to work. I think somebody already did that. So it was such an abstract title. So they were shooting down in Nassau. Not Nassau County, you know, the island. They were doing all that stuff down there. And I flew down there, and on the way down, I was reading a magazine, and it said that the Italians had a name for James Bond now, which was Mr. Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, which I thought was really terrific. So I thought, instead of using the word Thunderball, why don't we write a song called Mr. Kiss Kiss Bang Bang? Cubby absolutely loved it. Harry loved it. Everybody fell in love with it. So I recorded. I recorded with Dionne Warwick. We recorded with Shirley. And then the powers that be at United Artists in New York, literally 2 weeks before the movie opened, phoned up and said, you know, we need that Goldfinger thing. We need that title over the radio. And Mr. Kiss Kiss Bang Bang isn't doing it. We need Thunderball. So I called up Don Black and I said, look, I got this, we got to do this in like no time whatsoever. So I said, what does it mean? And he said, I don't know what the hell it means. I really don't know what it means. So I wrote a theme that facilitated the word. Don then wrote the lyric. He then called Tom Jones. And now the whole Bond thing was being a big success. You know, you could have called anybody. You know, everybody now wanted to do Bond songs because of the success that Shirley had had and the whole aura that was hanging around the movies. So Tom came in, and he said the first thing when he heard it, he said, what the hell's it about? In his Welsh accent, what the hell's it about? I said, Tom, don't ask. Just take a leaf out of Shirley's book, get in the studio, sing the hell out of it, and leave. Please, don't get into it. Just do that. And he said, oh, all right, okay, I'll do it. So he goes, Thunderball, and it was the same. It was the same mood. Just convince everybody. And he was so convincing. I don't think anybody really analyzed what the hell he was singing about. And I still don't know what the song is about to this day, but we were given that problem, and we have to live with it.
Well, the lyricist came up with good ideas for Thunderball. They call him the winner who takes all, and he
yes,
strikes
Don
like
did.
Thunderball.
Absolutely.
A decent solution
yeah, he
to
did.
The problem.
He did actually, in the nick of time, come out with that line, which made it slightly credible, you know.
I love these lyrics. They're so funny. His days of asking are all gone. His fight goes on and on and on.
Right, right.
So you must have had fun doing this.
Actually,
I mean, this is just really, it's very silly and very fun.
Talk about a license to kill. It's a license
right.
to write silly and just have great fun. You know, I mean, that was the whole joy of these movies, that this was not Citizen Kane, you know. It was just this fun comic strip. So you could get away with murder. If this had been a one-off, some guy made a movie called Thunderball, and it hadn't had the cachet that was growing up around the whole thing, we'd have been thrown out of the studio. It was the whole thing just... It was we were launched. And we could do any you could do anything really silly, and it's that was the freedom of it, and why I left ultimately was because it stopped being wonderful and silly. It started to be formula, and that's when the fun went out of it. And once the fun goes out of it, well, there's really no point.
Well, it's time to hear Thunderball, sung by Tom Jones, music by my guest John Barry.
While others walk, he acts while other men just talk. He looks at this world and wants it all, so he strikes.
success. His needs are more, so he gives less. They call him the winner who takes all, and he strikes like thunderbolt.
Talk about big arrangements. That is really great. I like the way you managed to work in the James Bond theme underneath it. Very nice.
Every trick in the book we use, believe me, we didn't leave anything out.
We'll talk more with John Barry after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is composer John Barry. He wrote the music for 11 James Bond movies. Now, we've been focusing on the theme songs, but of course you did, you know, the scores for the whole movies and underscoring for action scenes and scenes where Bond is being, you know, tied up or about to be lasered to death. Or
right.
There's a snake or a poisonous spider in his bed,
right,
or he's about to be executed or whatever. So do you have a favorite scene in how it works with the music that you did for that, where something terrible was about to happen to James Bond?
Oh, God, there's so many. I used to put myself in, like when I used to go to my father's cinema and sit in the front row on a Saturday afternoon and get absolutely thrilled by what was going up there. I tried to put myself into that area. And I guess the in Goldfinger, where he's laid down on the laser thing and the laser's going up between his legs, that's kind of a worrying thought. I guess that was like the epitome of, oh my God, you know. I mean, that was pretty special stuff.
Let's hear the actual scene from the movie.
This is gold, Mr. Bond. All my life I've been in love with its color, its brilliance, divine heaviness. I welcome any enterprise that will increase my stock, which is considerable.
I think you've made your point, Goldfinger. Thank you for the demonstration.
Choose your next witticism carefully, Mr. Bond. It may be your last. The purpose of our two previous encounters is now very clear to me. I do not intend to be distracted by another. Good night, Mr. Bond.
Do you expect me to talk?
No, Mr. Bond, I expect you to die. There is nothing you can talk to me about that I don't already know.
You're forgetting one thing. If I fail to report, 008 replaces me.
I trust he will be more successful.
Well, he knows what I know.
You know nothing, Mr. Bond.
Operation Grand Slam, for instance.
Overheard, which cannot possibly have any significance to you or anyone in your organization.
Can you afford to take that chance?
You are quite right, Mr. Bond. You are worth more to me alive.
That's music composed by my guest John Barry for the film Goldfinger. When Sean Connery left, the James Bond movies, and you stayed on and continued writing a while longer. Did you feel like the music had to change at all because the character portraying Bond was changing?
Yes. Sean, and when you look at the old, when I see the old footage of the Sean movies, I just go, oh my God, God, was it there? Was it so blatantly there? There was no question. And then we did On Her Majesty's Secret Service, and with Lazenby, and I overwrote. I really, a lot of people think that's the best Bond score that ever was. Believe me, a lot of Bond fans think that that was the best score. And I was trying to make up for the fact that Sean wasn't there musically. Really, no, that was the trip I took. But I think Pierce actually is the closest in terms of attitude to what Sean was. He's the nearest thing. The golden days with Sean, you could never get away from that. And those terrible lines he had to say. I mean, he had to say some of the worst lines ever written. And he brought them off. He brought off these words. Well, I guess he got the point, you know, when he shot that spear into the guy. And I mean, they were terrible lines. And, you know, it's really extraordinary for an actor to bring off a line that corny and make the audience go with it.
Well, John Barry, I want to thank you so much for talking with us. I've really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Well, I thank you, Terry. And I thank you for your knowledge and your love of things I've done. And I hope it's been an entertaining program.
John Barry composed the music for 11 James Bond movies. Our interview was recorded in 1999. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor, a new series of university-quality courses on compact disc, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by the German Information Center, the shortcut to Germany on the web at www.german.info. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
What's new, pussycat? Whoa, whoa, whoa. What's
coming
new,
up, our series Big Bombastic, Brassy and Trashy continues with brassy over-the-top pop hits from Tom Jones. He'll talk about his music, that sexy image, and getting rediscovered by a younger generation who weren't throwing their panties at him.
So go and powder your cute little pussycat nose. Pussycat, pussycat, I love you. Yes, I do. You and your pussycat nose. What's new, pussycat? Whoa, whoa, whoa. What's new, pussycat? Whoa, whoa, whoa. Pussycat, pussycat, you're so thrilling and I'm so willing to care for you. So go and make up your big little pussycat eyes. Pussycat, pussycat, I love you. Yes, I do. You and your pussycat eyes. What's new, pussycat? Whoa, whoa, whoa. What's new, pussycat? Whoa, 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 whoa.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today's the brassy day of our big, bombastic, brassy and trashy week. Tom Jones' big voice was backed up by lots of brass on some of his great over-the-top recordings like It's Not Unusual and What's New Pussycat, which started his career with a bang in 1965. The hits kept coming through the early 70s, including Thunderball, Green Green Grass of Home, Delilah, and She's a Lady. Jones made a comeback in 1987 when he collaborated with the group The Art of Noise on a cover of Prince's song Kiss. He made another comeback in 1999 with an album called Reload that went multi-platinum in the UK and Europe and featured his collaborations with performers like Van Morrison and the Cardigans. I spoke with Tom Jones late last year when a version of that CD, with the addition of several of his early hits, was released in the States. Let's talk about your first hit, It's Not Unusual. And this kind of really sets the style for you. Like, you know, lots of brass, a big arrangement. And this is the era when we're talking about the Beatles, the Rolling Stones. This is 1965. In America, it was, you know, like the height of the British invasion. You know, Herman's Hermits, the Rolling Stones, Petula Clark, the Beatles are all on the hits, along with Motown. And you're coming along and doing this, like, really kind of brassy. It's not a guitar band. It's not a band of songwriters. Did you feel like you were going to be, like, sticking out like a sore thumb in a way, doing something really different?
No. What was happening was, when the guy that was recording me, Peter Sullivan, when he saw me in a club in Wales, he was looking for more rock material.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was singing, you know, the band that I had then were three guitars and drums. You know, lead guitar, rhythm guitar, bass guitar and drums. So I was singing more rock tunes, 50s rock tunes. You know, Jerry Lee Lewis things and Little Richard and Fats Domino, Chuck Berry, you know, that kind of Elvis Presley, of course. So that's the kind of stuff that I was doing. Later, I was doing demonstration records for other singers because my manager was also a songwriter. So I would be doing demos for this music publishing company. And one day I did the song called It's Not Unusual, which my manager wrote for a girl called Sandy Shaw, who was having hits in England at the time. So when I heard it played back, I said, Gordon, you know, this, Gordon Mills, the man's name was, I said, this is, you know, this sounds like a hit to me. He said, yeah, but it's not rock enough for you. You know, it's a pop song. It's a mild song. So Peter Sullivan, my recording manager, said, look, if you're going to do this song, we've got to beef it up. We have to make it hotter than the song really calls for, you know, because it was more like a sort of a Brazil 66 type tune. So Peter said, what about brass? What if we put some brass in it? We need to beef it up because you're singing it, you know, you're singing it aggressively. We need the arrangement to complement that. So then Les Reed, who did the arrangement and co-wrote the song, put the brass on it. And that's, you know, the brass just played along to the bayon beat that the bass drum of the bass drum was doing. So it made it more of an aggressive record because of my style of singing.
Well, why don't we hear it? This is Tom Jones' first big hit, It's Not Unusual, and it's included on his new CD, Reloaded Greatest Hits.
It's not unusual to be loved by anyone. It's not unusual to have fun with anyone. But when I see you hanging about with anyone, it's not unusual to see me cry. I wanna die. It's not unusual to go out at any time. But when I see you out and about, it's such a crime. If you should ever wanna be loved by anyone, it's not unusual, it happens every day. No matter what you say, you'll find it happens all the time. Love will never do what you want to do. Why can't this crazy love be more?
That's Tom Jones. It's included on his new CD, Reloaded Greatest Hits, and it includes old and new material. One of the things that apparently always happens at your concerts is that there are some women who throw their panties at you, throw them onto the stage. Do you remember the very first time that happened?
It was in the Copacabana in New York in 1968. It was a supper club, and the singer is on the same... the stage, the band is on the stage, but the singer is on the dance floor, which is at and all these tables, you know, tables and chairs all around you with the people. And I was perspiring a lot, so these ladies were handing me table napkins. And then this one woman stood up and took her underwear off and, you know, handed them to me. And it was written up in the newspaper the following day, and that's what started it. And that was in 68, and I went to Vegas the same year, and then the room keys, you know, started, because people that are in Vegas are staying in the hotels, and they have, you know, room keys in their handbags or their purses. So, you know, it was the stage would be showered with the underwear and room keys. So that went on for quite a while. But, you know, when it first started, it was very sexy, because I don't think any woman had ever thrown underwear at a singer before. I don't think it ever happened before that, or for that matter, throwing a room key up there, you know. So it was very sexy at the time, but then it became a bit of a joke, because people would bring underwear, you know, in handbags and just throw them up there because they thought it was the thing to do. So it backfired on me a bit.
So when you started to think like it was backfiring, what did you do anything to try to stop it?
Well, I didn't. At the beginning, you know, I would pick them up and play around with them, you know, because you learn that whatever happens on stage, you try to turn it to your advantage and not get thrown by it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you'd work with it, you know, and but after a while, because it became, you know, it was happening so much, I decided not to do it. If they threw them at me, then just let them fall where they will, you know. So that's what's happened now.
I want to play another record, and this is Delilah, and this is another one of your really like big productions with, you know, like big arrangement behind you, and you're like you're so passionate in this that you have to murder the woman. <You
know>? Yeah. it was a song that was written by Les Reed, who co-wrote "It's Not Unusual," and. You know, he wrote the song and played it to me, and I said, yes, it sounds great. You know, it sounds, but it really is. It's a passionate song because, you know, the man, as you say, actually kills the woman because she was unfaithful to him.
Let's hear the song. This is another one of Tom Jones' hits from the 60s, Delilah.
Flickering shadows of love on her blind. She was my woman. As she deceived me, I watched and went out of my mind.
That's Tom Jones singing Delilah. It's one of his early recordings that's included on his new CD, Tom Jones Reloaded Greatest Hits, which also includes new recordings. I want to tell you a story about that song. Our director, Roberta, told me today that a friend of hers, when this friend was, I think, 13, she went to a big club in New Jersey, the Latin Casino, with her mother. She was wearing a yellow chiffon dress. This was like 1969. And they were going to hear you. And when you sang Delilah, this 13-year-old girl just felt kind of possessed and taken over. And she just, She this is very out of character, apparently, but she approached the stage, walked up on it, and presented mm-hmm. herself to you. And you apparently were very nice about the whole thing. You sang to her a little bit, gave her a little kiss, and then sent her back to her seat. Right. Did this kind of thing happen a lot?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, people tried to get on stage. I mean, right up to today, you know, you have to have security there to make sure. But with children, you know, if a child comes to the stage, then you know you can't ignore that. So, you do the best you can without making anybody embarrassed or anything. You know, you try to do it in the best way that you can. But I love kids. I love to see kids enjoying themselves in an audience. So, but you have to try and keep everything in perspective, you know. So that's what the security is there for.
My guest is Tom Jones. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is singer Tom Jones. His hits of the 60s and 70s include It's Not Unusual, What's New Pussycat, and Delilah. Okay, time for another song. Now, this is another one of your big hits, What's New Pussycat. And the really funny thing about this song, it's your big novelty hit, but it's written by the brilliant and very sophisticated songwriting team of Burt Bacharach and Hal David. So yeah. This was a theme for a movie of the same name. How did you get to sing the title song?
Well, Burt Bacharach wanted, which he told me, you know, when I met him, he wanted a big voice to sing the song because it was for a Woody Allen film, and it was a crazy movie, and it's a crazy song, really. So he said, I need a big, solid voice to make this legitimate. You know, it needs to be done with conviction and not, don't sing it lightheartedly. He said, if you do that, it won't work. You got to really, you know, dig into it and make a serious job of it. So that's why he asked me to do it, because he'd heard It's Not Unusual, you know, and like that. And the flip side of It's Not Unusual was a Burt Bacharach song called To Wait for Love, you know, which was a ballad. So I don't know whether he heard It's Not Unusual because he had the song on the flip side or not. But he liked the sound of my voice, and he thought I would be, you know, I would be right for What's New Pussycat. And
how did you like the song?
Well, when he first played it to me, I didn't like it. Because I couldn't quite... because it's a very unusual tune, you see. It's... So he played it on piano and he sang it to me when he was writing the music for the movie. He was doing it in London. And I couldn't understand it at first. It was alien to me, to the stuff that I'd been listening to. So... And I told him so. You know, I said, I can't make head or tail of this bloody thing. So he said, well, look, I'll make a demo of it. So the following day, he went into the studio and he made a demonstration record, just him and the piano, you know, doing it. And he said, live with it and listen to it. And then hopefully, you know, it'll hit you. And it did. So, but I still wasn't sure until I actually recorded it. We got into the studio at night. It was a night session. It was from midnight till 4 in the morning. And when we came out with it, I knew what he was talking about. You know, I got it then.
Well, let's hear it. This is Tom Jones, What's New Pussycat?
What's new, pussycat? Whoa, whoa, whoa. What's new, pussycat? Whoa. Pussycat, I've got flowers and lots of hours to spend with you. So go and powder your cute little pussycat nose. Pussycat, pussycat, I love you. Yes, I do. You and your pussycat nose. What's new, pussycat? Whoa, whoa, whoa. What's new, pussycat? Whoa, 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 whoa. Pussycat, pussycat.
That's Tom Jones, one of the recordings included on his new CD, Reloaded Greatest Hits, which is a mix of old and new material. Your career has been going strong for nearly 40 years. Was there ever a point in your career where you worried, it's ending, I'm on the verge of being washed up, it's going to be over really soon?
No, because my voice has always carried me through that. I mean, even when the records, you know, got a bit slim, you know, when I wasn't getting hit records, my live performances made up for it. People were coming to see me. So that's what kept me going. If the audiences had dwindled, if I had gone on stage and I wasn't doing business, then I would think I'm doing something wrong. You know, something is not happening here. But that never happened. You know, the audience. I've toured every year. You know, ever since I started, I've always gone out to the people, and thank God they've come to see me. So that's, you know, that's what's always given me confidence to keep doing it.
What about when you realized that a lot of the women throwing their panties at you were middle-aged? You know, did that make you feel old, too, or older, too, or make you feel like, you know, that it had become such shtick?
Well, it's because of the mixture. You see, it wasn't always that way. You see, the thing is, because of the media saying that, a lot of housewives, you know, come to see Tom Jones.
Right.
And throw their underwear, that was only a handful of people. There were a lot of younger people there as well, you know, and there were a lot of men, not only female. I mean, some of the write-ups that that I was getting, some of the reviews, you would think that the only people in the audience were middle-aged housewives. There were middle-aged housewives there, but there were a lot of young girls there, a lot of young boys there. You know, there were a lot of older fellas there as well. So there's always been a big mixture of people. But I think it was because women had never reacted in that way before. That's what made it different. You know, teenagers, of course, you know, you get teenage idols and you get young girls screaming at the teenage idols. But I don't think women had ever done it before. So that's what they went for. That's what they, the write-ups were always about that. But they should have taken into consideration there was a lot of other people there as well.
Did you ever ask yourself why some of your following was middle-aged women who were doing things that middle-aged women hadn't done to performers before?
Mm-hmm. I think it's the masculinity, you know, because I was a man. This is what I've been told anyway, you know, that I looked like a man. I didn't look like a boy, and they could relate to me. And men have told me that as well. You know, men have said, look, my girlfriend, you know, she digs you, and I don't mind because I, you know, I love the way you sing as well. And the same thing with husbands. You know, I've been told that if a woman likes somebody that the husband or boyfriend doesn't like, you know, who's a bit effeminate or, you know, not masculine enough, they don't like that. But in my case, you know, they said you're a man's man as well, so there was no problem.
My guest is Tom Jones. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Woman, I can remember a woman. Warm were her kisses and tender was she, lying there in my arms. Why did you deceive me so? What devil inside made you go when I needed you most?
My guest is singer Tom Jones. His hits of the 60s and 70s include It's Not Unusual, What's New Pussycat, and Delilah. Well, we've been playing a bunch of your early hits. Let's hear something new, or a couple of years old, but pretty new, from your new CD. And this is called Sex Bomb. And it's you and Moose T, who, I confess, I don't know. So you can tell me who Moose T is and how this record came to be.
Right. Well, Moose T is a German record producer, songwriter, and the big hit that he had before was Horny, Horny, Horny. It was a big dance record. Uh-huh. So then he wrote Sex Bomb with a lyricist called Errol Reynolds, and they sent me the demo on it and asked me what I'd like to do it. So I thought it was a very commercial-sounding song. So we just changed the lyrics slightly because they wanted me to sing, I'm a sex bomb and I can turn you on. So I said, you're a sex bomb and you can turn me on. So I think
why did you make that switch?
Well, then it's for anybody. It's for everybody. You know, it's for anybody that thinks that they're a sex bomb. You know, I mean, any lady or any girl or any woman that, you're a sex bomb and you can turn me on. But if I'm saying it, it's only me. You know, I'm a sex bomb, I can turn you on. I think it's a bit bragging a little too much. So we just reversed roles there. But then again, you know, kids, a lot of kids that sing it, I don't think they even were aware of that. It's the chorus, you know, sex bomb, sex bomb. I mean, that's what they're getting. I don't think they were too concerned whether it's I'm a sex bomb or you're a sex bomb. We might have overthought it, but that's what happened anyway.
Well, it's very catchy. Here it is. This is Tom Jones, Sex Bomb. That's Tom Jones, one of the recent tracks included on his CD, Reloaded Greatest Hits, a mix of old and new material. You, as we've discussed, have this very swarthy image. When you were young, you were in bed for a year. You had tuberculosis.
Mm-hmm.
How did a year of...
Well, it was two years.
2 years.
Mm-hmm.
How did 2 years of being sick, and you can tell me how old you were because I'm not sure.
Yeah, 12.
Right, okay.
I was 12 to 14.
Oh, just as your voice is changing too, huh?
Well, yeah, going through puberty too.
Boy, I mean, that's a lot to go through at one time, particularly
exactly.
For a singer.
Yeah, to be locked up, you know, in at that age is, you know, seeing the girls playing in the street and not being able to go out is not only the girls, I mean all my friends, but, you know, that's when you start to notice girls, really.
Right.
Is at that time, so it was a very frustrating time for me.
Well, how did it affect your life to be sick for a couple of years, years that are turning points in every child's life? Mm.
Well, another thing was they told me that I shouldn't sing, you know, because I shouldn't do anything that I couldn't put any effort into anything, you know, I couldn't do anything physical, no physical activity. So I turned to then drawing. You know, I used to sketch a lot and paint a lot when I was a kid, so that's what. I put my talent, into that. I had to do something to express myself, so I did a lot of sketches. But that was the terrible thing, was not being able to sing. But it was one. It did teach me a lesson, though. You see, something good came out of it, and it's not to take it to take life for granted. Because, you know, when you can play in the streets or you can play in the hills, you know, in Wales, most kids just take that for granted. But when it's taken away from you and you're bedridden for 2 years, it's I thought to myself then, when I get out of bed, once I can play again, you know, with the kids and I can go wherever I want to go. I'll never complain about anything else as long as I live. And that's, you know, that's kept me... I remember being bedridden. And so that helped. It helped in a certain... And another thing, it stopped me going into the coal mines, because in Wales at that time, you see, a lot of people were going into... My father was a coal miner, and maybe I would have become a coal miner, but because I had tuberculosis, you know, on the lung, the doctor said, you know, you cannot work in a coal mine. So that was a blessing in disguise as well.
Did you see singing as an alternative to the mine world yourself?
Well, no, singing to me was a very natural thing to do. I wasn't thinking that it would sort of get me out of Wales or anything. I loved living in Wales. But it was a thing that singing was a thing that I loved to do. And I did think to myself when I was a child, you know, I thought, if I could do this as a profession, this would be fantastic. You know, this is what I want to do. Not to do, you know, have to do a job of work that you don't like, you know, in order to make money, which most people have to do in order to survive. You know, I thought, if I could do this, you know, I have a gift here, and if I could do it as a profession, then that would be, you know, that would be it for me. And thank God it turned out that way.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
That's okay. My pleasure.
Tom Jones recorded late last year. Our big, bombastic, brassy and trashy week continues tomorrow. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Megan Howell. Roberta Shurrock directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
It's not unusual to go out at any time, but when I see you out and about, it's such a crime. If you should ever want to be loved by anyone, it's not unusual, it happens every day. No matter what you say, you'll find it happens all the time. Love will never do what you want to do. Why can't this crazy love be mine? It's not unusual to be mad with anyone. It's not unusual to be sad with anyone. But if I ever find that you've changed at any time, it's not unusual to find that I'm in love with you. Oh, 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 oh.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor, a new series of university-quality courses on compact disc, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com, and from Dial Press, publisher of The Rule of Four, a debut suspense novel of the puzzling connection between an ancient manuscript and an Ivy League murder by Ian Caldwell and Dustin Thomason. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we continue our series Big, Bombastic, Brassy, and Trashy with B-Movies. We'll hear from the King of the Bees, producer and director Roger Corman, and Dick Miller and Peter Fonda will talk about starring in Corman films. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.